Hi, this is the Reverend Marek Zabriskie, the rector of Christ Church, Greenwich. And I'm joined by my co-podcast leader, Andrew Boyer, who it's always great to do these podcasts with you, Andrew.
Good to be back. It's a good one.
And our special guest today is the Episcopal Archbishop of Jerusalem, Hossam Naum. It is such an honor to have you here in Greenwich with us and to speak on the Calling podcast.
And the pleasure is mine, Father Marek. Thank you very much. And Andrew, it's wonderful to see you.
So you have one of the most extraordinary dioceses in the world. You're in five different countries, if not more. You've got churches, and 28 of them, and schools and hospitals in Jerusalem, Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and even Yemen. What is it like to run such a diverse diocese? And can you tell us a little bit about, like, you have a church in Yemen and one in Syria. Can you even go visit them? And what is it like to try to serve, you know, these incredible institutions so far and so wide scattered?
Yeah, indeed. I think one of the blessings of being in such a diocese like Jerusalem, that, you know, like, I always say that, you know, all the events that took place within the Gospels and the time of Jesus, they took basically place within the Diocese of Jerusalem, except one event that kind of slipped our fingers, and that is the flight to Egypt. Other than that, every single event is within the Diocese of Jerusalem, you know, from the Nativity to the Resurrection, into the Decapolis, into Tyre and Sidon, and all of those places. So it is really a blessing, you know, to imagine, you know, like kind of being custodians, spiritual custodians of these places and ancient sites and ancient stones, and the kind of the complexity of being in such a diverse place is actually like trying to reconcile the identity of people that exist within the diocese. You know, the different politics, the different histories, or in a sense, you know what I mean, like the layers of histories that cover that part of the world which is really ancient. So I think for me, as a bishop who runs places like Israel with the Arab countries that surrounds it, you know, for over the years, things have been different as we go from one phase to another. And how can we imagine our living and offering pastoral care, you know, continue to do these ministries in the midst of war, changing of borders, changing of, you know, all sorts of dimensions within the diocese. And I will give you just a glimpse, like if I want to write a statement for the diocese, any statement, maybe it has some political connotation or anything like that. It is really hard to write because how can you speak a statement on behalf of everyone when there is so much diversity and sometimes contradiction within the narratives that exist within the diocese? And I think this is where I think I find solace and comfort when I engage in pastoral care, that I simply express the imaginative way of the church itself and speak the language that I would say that Jesus would have spoken in that situation.
You know, you grew up in Nazareth, which I think is fascinating. So you kind of grew up right where Jesus was. What was that like in terms of like living through history in that regard? Did that kind of in any way sort of shape the path you took?
You know, when I was a little child, I always thought that everyone in the world has the same experience like me because that was my world. And it's only when I started like meeting people from other parts of the world initially, and when I started traveling around the world, when I began to appreciate the place more, if you know what I mean. I took it for granted when I was a little child. But then I realized, you know, like, wow, you know, like I'm living in the place where Jesus walked, literally, just to go to school or to go to work or to go to do things like normal day of life or even getting grocery, just to think that, you know, like I'm walking where Jesus walked. It's such a great gift, but also with that gift comes great responsibility that to keep the voice of the gospel alive in the place where it all happened.
So this podcast is called The Calling, and we always make sure we ask our guests a little bit about how they got their calling into whatever field they've gone into. How did you experience your calling to become a priest, and how old were you, and what happened?
Yeah, so since I was a child, and I always like grew up in the church, and my parents were in the choir as well since they were like young, and it was always wonderful to be in a church community because that felt for us like a refuge, you know, like it's a place where we gather, a place where we celebrate our identity as Christians, and a safe place for us. So that I always grew up in that atmosphere of church and singing hymns. Even at home, we would gather around, you know, after the Easter lunch or Christmas lunch, and to sing carols and to sing hymns, you know, and just to be joyful at the spirit that, you know, like the season is given to us. And I continued to do that, you know, like when I went into confirmation classes and youth gatherings and so on and so forth. So if I may say so, I didn't have a Damascus Road experience of conversion, but I think I grew into loving the church since my childhood. And for me, like, I believe that Christian traditioning and passing on of the faith is really important when we engage with children. And that's why, for me, youth ministry is really at the heart of what I do now, even as a bishop. Because when I was still like the dean or a priest, for me, youth camps and summer school and working with children was really what brought me joy and what brought really kind of comfort in my ministry.
When you were a kid and you were at school, were you like one of the very few Christians in the school, or was it mostly Christian, or what was it?
So I was the only Protestant in this class. So, you know, I remember the history teacher, you know, like he was a Muslim teacher, and he would look at me. He also was my neighbor, like my parents' neighbor. So he would come to me. Oh, so we're talking about like the Reformation and Martin Luther. And he said, oh, Hussam, you will become a priest, a pastor. Like, this is what the word they, you will become a pastor one day. You know, imagine. So for I was the only Protestant Anglican. But also, I would say, one of very few in the classroom who were Christians.
So when you were 19, you went off to Rhodes University in Grahamstown, South Africa, to study for seminary. What was it like to uproot from where you spent your whole life? And was that your first time abroad? And then you're looking back, and all of a sudden you must be seeing Israel and Palestine in a completely different light because you're in this other country and starting to wonder, what's this like in this? What was that experience like?
Well, I think for me, like being at the Rhodes University and also the College of Transfiguration was absolutely transformational, you know, like in my own spirituality and journey of faith. Because, you know, one of the most important things that I have learned there is contextual theology. That was really kind of a different perspective, you know, to think intentionally about, you know, like the Bible and the relation of the Bible to the people's story. For that matter, you know, like, you know, the Exodus story, how it speaks to the African people in South Africa in their strive for liberation, for example. You know, for me, coming from the Holy Land, because the Bible, it speaks about my own hometown. Like when we speak about Nazareth, Bethlehem, Nain, you know, all of these places are around my house, you know, around my home. And for me, like, I felt like, you know, I'm still living the same story of the Bible and didn't need to challenge myself if the Bible speaking to my context or not, because it is my context, if you know what I mean. With all the bits and pieces, the way we eat, the way we treat each other, the way we greet each other, you know, all the kind of the Bible language is still alive within my community. So that's one important kind of diversion, and became more intentional how the Bible speaks to my context in the here and now. And the second thing is the whole ministry of reconciliation. And I have to say that Archbishop Desmond Tutu was certainly one of my not only heroes but mentors, you know, in being in South Africa. And I got to see him quite often. And he used to call me the kid from Nazareth, whose dad is a carpenter. And my dad is a carpenter, but he said, I will stop there. I won't say more. But it is kind of the whole concept of reconciliation kind of really shaped the way I look at things, even in my own context. And to see how God called us into this ministry of reconciliation is such a precious thing to think about and to exercise and to live as we bring people together. So these are the two most important things that I brought with me from South Africa.
So what are some of the gifts that Desmond Tutu taught you about reconciliation? Because he lived in something very similar. And when I think of you, I think of an extrapolation of his ministry. And I think how blessed the Holy Land is to have you, because they need someone with those gifts to bring people who are so pitted against each other together. What are some of the teachings or things that he modeled that you say, I think about this quite a bit, or I try to put this into action?
You know, he has like a many famous lines, but, you know, like some like stood out. And when he established the College of the Transfiguration, the college, the seminary I went into together with Rhodes University next door, he brought two colleges together. One was St. Paul's for white people, and the other one was St. Bede's for black people, Africans, and St. Peter's for colored people. So that kind of resembled the old South African. And he said that I'm establishing a Transfiguration College because we are the transfigured people. We are transformed and no longer are divided by color. So that's the whole issue of transfiguration being changed has become something really important. And how are we like having the mountain of transfiguration only like 15 minutes drive from my home? You know, whenever I drive past it or I visit it, I remember, you know, like God's calling us to be agents of transformation and change in our own context. And the other one that was really kind of also like spoke to me in tremendous way was when he said, you know, we South African, we need to be colorblind in a positive sense. Well, colorblind, like when I look at my neighbor, I see in her or in him a human being. Not a person of color or a person of this or that or background. So I think, you know, today, since we don't have that challenge of color in the Holy Land, we rather have that challenge of religion. Now, are we able to say that, you know, I am religion blind, that I look at every human person that as God's children? And how do I relate to people? How we can really preach the message of love and Christ's message into peace and light where we speak about the people of the Holy Land, whether they are Muslims or Jews? Can we relate to them as children of God or not? I think these are the kinds of qualities that I would say that have benefited from Archbishop Desmond Tutu, bless his soul, that really have really kind of imprinted in me something that will stay with me for the rest of my life.
So October 7th, that horrific attack takes place. Can you tell us where you were when you heard about that and what you began to do and what you've been doing for the past 6 months too? It's probably absolutely transformed how you've had to go about ministry and where you've had to prioritize and where the diocese has had to put energy, protect people. You've got people who can't get paid anymore to do their work and trying to care for them and their families. What was it like that day, and how did you have to pivot to address it?
You know, like, first of all, let me begin by saying, like, you know, what happened that day is really horrific and really kind of makes us all hurt and ache for what happened. You know, and with that incident on the 7th, you know, comes a lot of incidents and days that preceded it that just adds to the hurt and the wounds of the people of the Holy Land. And I just happened to be in Gaza visiting our hospital on the 4th of October, just 2 days before this took place. And the first thing that happened, like really kind of came to my mind, selfishly speaking for that matter, when it erupted, like what would have happened if this happened when I was in Gaza on the 4th, just 2 days before. And I just put myself in the shoes of so many people who have been killed or hurt or kidnapped or you know, like assaulted or whatever happened there. And there's so much suffering on that day and then the 6 months that followed with so much killing and violence in Gaza, the destruction and everything else. So I think, you know, like, you know, for me, as someone who really kind of cares for both sides of the conflict in a sense that Israel and Palestine is part of my diocese. And of course, it reaches even beyond, you know, is how can I be a shepherd for the people on every side? It is such a difficult position to be in. It's a huge challenge and it's complex. But I think, you know, again, yes, I am the bishop for the Anglican Church. But, you know, that doesn't mean that you know, other people are not part of my pastoral care if I have the energy and the opportunity to help or to reach an arm.
What's it like, you know, for you and your family? I mean, this is just my impression because I have no idea what it's like to live in a place under in wartime. But is there just kind of constant fear and stress living where you do? Or is it, do you sort of get used to it? Or how do you deal with it?
You know, I think, you know, like no one would want to kind of get used to any situation like this. But the irony of it is that, you know, after such a long time, like now, how you feel now about the conflict is not the same how you felt at it in the beginning, which is something that, you know, it is a blessing that's given to human people to adjust. And, you know, if we can even think about bereavement, when you lose someone, when someone loses somebody dear to their heart, you know, time heals and God gives us that kind of gift of forgetting or adjusting into the new situation. So in that sense, yes, you know, like you get used to certain way of life, you have to adjust, you know that you can't go anytime you want or anywhere you want at certain point in time. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that the hurt and the difficulty and the worrying and the anxiety disappeared. It is there, but you have found ways to work through those things. And I believe, you know, like, you know, every human person deserves life with dignity. This is our baptismal covenant. And I think, and I hope that, you know, whatever we do in the Diocese of Jerusalem, you know, helps achieve that dignity that is in that every human person is entitled to.
You know, our country has become so divided in things now, and it's so easy for people to go down rabbit holes politically. I'm so impressed with how you don't do that. What advice would you give us as a people, and what do you tell your clergy, your hospital staff, your school staff, to keep them from going down political rabbit holes and to see the humanity in everyone and to try to pull people together?
You know, there's one thing that, you know, like for me, like, you know, we have a clergy who have not different point of views, but they have different ways of expressing themselves. So you'll have those who would engage in politics and make statements and take a view about what's happening. And especially, like, we as Palestinian people, like, you know, like, we are not like spectators, or we are indifferent, or we are outside the conflict. You know, we are part and parcel of what is going on. So for them to speak about their context, there is kind of a margin of freedom for them to express on behalf of their own people what they're going through. But I always advise them, you know, like, to think also that every human person is God's child. Now, I think, you know, if God's children do something wrong or they get astray, that doesn't mean they are condemned to death, but rather it is our role in order to kind of bring them back to God, so to speak, if we want to speak the language of repentance. The idea is that, you know, like, you know, we have to, first of all, our first mission is to care for our own congregations and our own people. That comes first. And then with that comes, you know, like, you know, the wider ripple of that is that to be also a pastor for the whole community, the whole town that you are serving. So if you are in Nablus, for example, you know, you're through the hospital and the work of the congregation, you do care for the people who live there. So each one of us, each priest and pastor, each director of an institution, they have a lot to cope with. That goes way beyond the politics of the conflict, because at the essence of our ministry is the human person. And I know it's sometimes difficult to differentiate that because it's all complex, it's all kind of tied together, mixed together. And I always advise them, like, you know, keep your eye on the prize. And that is the love of Christ for everybody. don't forget that you are a man or a woman of God, and you ought to care for everyone. Don't forget this. Otherwise, this is where getting into a rabbit hole becomes problematic, I think.
Yeah, I watched a few of your interviews, and it reminded me of like being a middle child in a way that you're constantly just trying to sort of keep things even keeled and not take a side. But is there a bigger role for the Christian church or the diocese in the sort of the process of peace, or is it really, how do you sort of see the role of the church?
No, I think, if we are talking about the church as the whole Christian presence in the whole land, it's yes. I think, we as the heads of churches, we are really united and committed together in order to promote all of those things that we've been talking about. And I think, being united together gives us not only strength, but also it gives us the position, to speak up and to be heard. And I have to say, in the last 3 years or so, the Council of the Heads of Churches have been not only heard, but also trusted that, the narrative that we are offering is being endorsed and complemented by the diplomatic corps and also governments even in Europe and other places. And I think we have opened that channel in order to kind of say that, it's not that we don't take sides as such or being indifferent, but we are saying let's look on how can we, as a church, bring a narrative that can bring people together, make them sit together, talk about peace, and find a solution for a bright future for everybody.
There's a fairly new book out called The Nine Quarters of Jerusalem, which I thought was exceptional. And what you said earlier in our forum made me think of that, because you talked about how Jerusalem doesn't belong to just one group, and it can never be. And what I got out of that book is, there are so many different mixes of people in Jerusalem that it's at its best when they can appreciate each other's qualities, whether it's the coffee they brew or a special pastry they make or, a Sufi dance, this incredible kind of gumbo of mixture of people's cultures and religions. What is the future of Jerusalem? And do you think there's any chance that there'll be a future that will eventually be shared by all? Or is it one group going to continuously try to claim it all for its own?
Thinking about, the gradual hymn we had this morning about Jerusalem, my happy home, and talking about the sorrow and the joy that the city brings, it reminded me of, a narrative within the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, that spoke about Jerusalem. And out of that narrative, came a song that was written one of our canons at the cathedral. And he, of course, with Psalm 122. Why I'm saying that introduction, because it says, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. And that is the chorus. And then the first stanza says, 10 measures of beauty God gave to the world, 9 to Jerusalem and 1 to the rest of the world. 10 measures of sorrow God gave to the world, 9 to Jerusalem and 1 to the rest. I think that means that exactly, talking about the joy and the sorrow being there in the city, side by side, so mingled together, that, I think it depends on in what lens you look at Jerusalem, you will find. So if your really intentionality is to look on the sorrows and the wounds and the conflict that is in Jerusalem, it's all over the place. But I think if you are more on the positive side of things and you would want to see the blessings and the joys that are in Jerusalem, I think they are countless. And that's why Jerusalem has such a great and powerful image and tapestry. And that is the true color of Jerusalem that brings all people. It's such a mosaic, a beautiful mosaic that we celebrate. And I think, if it wasn't for the extremists who want to kind of claim Jerusalem as their own exclusively, I think Jerusalem is supposed to be, and that's what the name of Jerusalem is about, is the city of light and peace is all about. And I think, people who want to kind of, there's the word peace in Jerusalem, we can play with it. It's peacing Jerusalem, bringing peace to Jerusalem, or piecing or dividing Jerusalem is exactly what we need to think about if we want to reflect on Jerusalem. And I think that Jerusalem has to continue to be God's city, not anybody's city.
Who are your key partners? Who, you know, I always say, like, I get shocked when Anglicans, Episcopalians now get very political and just lean one way or the other, because we've always been called the people of the middle way, the Via Media.
Indeed.
Who are your main partners that you sense they see, my Jewish colleagues here see it, the middle way, the need to get there, or my Muslim partners or my Christian partners? Who are you working with most closely that kind of get that need to pull together?
No, I think, you know, like we have, I would say I have friends from every group, like whether they are Orthodox or whether they are Reformed or conservative Jews, whether they are Muslims, they belong to Sufi or Sunni or even Shia in Lebanon or other places, or even Christians. You know, I think even Zionist Christians, you know, that we feel that we need to talk to as well, because they have kind of distinct narrative when it comes to the politics within the Holy Land. I think, you know, it's important that we preach and talk to everybody and not only to the choir. You know, we need to talk to all people and make our voice heard, because at the end of the day, our main intention is for the well-being and the common good of everybody. And I think this is the beauty about being a Via Media or the middle way. Is that just, it's an invitation to everyone, because it's easy, because, you know, being on the extreme, you know, those on the other side of things will find it a long way to go. Being in the Via Media, it's kind of inviting for people to make that short journey and join the celebration.
I never thought I'd see the Berlin Wall fall. I never thought I'd see Northern Ireland develop peace. Do you think in your lifetime you're going to see a two-state solution? And if so, what's it going to take to make that a reality?
You know, I think, selfishly speaking, I hope that will happen in my lifetime. But I think, you know, thinking about Jerusalem and its long history, thousands of years of civilization, so to speak, you know, like, you know, one day for the Lord is like 1,000, and 1,000 like one day. I think the journey itself that is being so painful throughout the last at least 100 years, let me say, has been like really dreadful. But I believe that, you know, at the end of the day, this conflict will bring about something that will be lasting for quite some time. I am hopeful, and we are, and there is a big difference between, by the way, by hopeful and being optimistic. You know, being hopeful that, you know, we are assured of that living hope through the power of the resurrection as we know it in the Bible, that it is really the promise that is to be fulfilled. And likewise, I am hopeful that at the end of this tunnel, dark tunnel, there must be the light of peace for everyone in the Holy Land. When do we realize this? I don't know. But again, it will happen. And that's, I'm hopeful about this.
You know, when I was 10, we went to Israel and to Jerusalem. And I remember them telling me the whole history. And my conclusion as a 10-year-old was like, oh, well, the Turks had it for a long time. And it seemed like, maybe we should just give it back to the Turks. And of course, everybody was sort of shocked. Like, I don't think that's such a good idea, kid. But I wonder to what extent, like, you know, and of course, there was the time when it was under the Roman Empire. But to what extent do you need an empire? Or do you need for there to be peace there? And in sort of our kind of tripolar world right now, you know, is there a role for somebody to come in and provide structure and order, do you think?
I think, you know, like looking at the history of Jerusalem, like people who have come from outside had made things difficult for the people of the Holy Land. You know, it becomes, if we can put it in today's language, it's more colonial than it is the people who are ruling themselves. I think if it's left to the people themselves, grassroots, who have been living there with each other for 2 millennia, I think, you know, they can do it together. But as long as, you know, we are concerned about regional politics and world geopolitical scenarios, we will always be drawn, like each group will be drawn to one scenario and one group. And this is the way it is. I'm not saying like this is bad or wrong or good, but the idea is that, you know, I think let us leave it for the people of the Holy Land to decide for themselves what is for their best and the future that they live together.
You operate 28 churches and over 30, 35 different hospitals and schools. What are you most concerned about right now? What's hurting the most? Is it the churches or the schools or the hospitals? And where do you need the most support?
Yeah, I think, you know, like most of the institutions are finding difficulty, especially in the very stressful, anxious situation that we find ourselves in. So because of the economy has been hurt so much, the unemployment, people are like afraid to spend. Even paying the tuition for the school has become like a risk in time of war. Like they want to save the money just to buy food if things deteriorate. But I would say that the hospitals is finding it most difficult, especially with the war going on and the injuries and all of that. And we have been treating people for free. Like if it was like, you know, like a normal place or anywhere in the world that we're giving treatment and you want something in return, we would have made a fortune, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I'm saying like just kind of economically speaking, but the Diocese of Jerusalem provides these institutions for charity and for needy people. And that's at the heart of what we do. And I think, you know, we were taught when we were children that the ones who give, they will be given. And that's how it is, you know, for the Diocese of Jerusalem. The more we give, God provides more for us in order to give more. And this has been like really, I would say, the anchor that keeps us going. Because, you know, we are not concerned about scarcity, but rather abundance. Because we are doing God's mission in and for the world.
So if there's someone out there listening who has great resources and they're touched by the plight of this situation, and they said, I'm gonna get behind this and try to make a big difference, where would their resources end up going in all likelihood? Where's the greatest need financially at this point that needs support?
You know, like I think, you know, like, yeah, that's a very good question, Father Merrick, really. Thank you for that. One thing that, you know, people would be concerned about also is how to get whatever they want to give, you know, to the Diocese of Jerusalem. And the answer is quite simple. Here in the States, our major donor and partner is the American Friends of the Diocese of Jerusalem. And they can Google that and find a way in which to get in touch with them. They're wonderful people and they want to help you, help us. But at the same time, you know, like within the American Friends, there are policies that they keep all the transparency and the credibility that every penny people give will go to the right people and for the purpose in which it has been given. And I think, you know, like over the years, we have built this trust and we continue to do so. And people who see on the ground what the Diocese of Jerusalem is doing, they can see for themselves. And I'm sure that you have been there and you've seen it yourself, Father. How the Diocese of Jerusalem is really enabling people to live a life of dignity with education, healthcare, rehabilitation, and also pastoral care within our congregations, whether youth ministry or women empowerment, and many other programs that we run throughout the diocese.
I understood that you had hospitals in Gaza, is that right?
That's
so
correct.
What's the state of them now?
The hospital itself is still working, and actually it is the only hospital in the north of Gaza that never stopped working. And this is by miracle, because the hospital is trusted and it's well known by everybody that it is a place of healing and a beacon of hope for so many people. And we are really indebted for the staff and for the volunteers and for Suhaila and her team, who have been working really so hard to keep the place open for everybody.
You had mentioned that something like 70,000 people have been maimed in addition to the 32,000 that have been killed. You know, 70,000 maimed by bombs, and there are many children who have had amputations and many more who need them. What is that like, and how is that affecting the personnel of the hospital? A surgeon who's, you know, had to remove limbs from children and teenagers.
Yeah. During the time of war and with the lack of equipment and medicine and all of that, unfortunately, they tend to, in order to save life, to have amputations. Unfortunately, this is really kind of it's a horrific picture that people had to deal with in Gaza. You know, I think the responsibility and the capacity to deal with all these cases is way beyond what anyone or any hospital can deal with. And that's why kind of we came to a situation from a health perspective, and people can go to the WHO and see the statistics of all of these numbers and how and where and they have happened. You know, for us, you know, I think we are determined in order to alleviate the suffering of people, especially for children. And now there is a collaboration between the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, which is the Anglican Hospital, and the Princess Basma Center in Jerusalem. They're working hand in hand in order to provide rehabilitation for children, especially those who have been affected and injured by the war, but also post-trauma kind of conditions in order to support those children in order to, you know, like restore some of their mental health or physical health.
Is that going to be just an absolutely enormous challenge moving forward to deal with traumatized children and families moving out of this war?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be done. Like now we don't know exactly, you know, like where things stand in terms of statistics, but I think the need will be great in the future.
I had one more question. I actually thought before I met you that you would be a very sort of stern, serious person based on everything that you're going through and everything you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So it's not quite as a pertinent question as I thought it might be, but how do you find joy in your daily life? Where do you find joy?
You know, I find joy, first of all, like within my family, having a family that, you know, that shows you love and everything, despite everything I do to them. I'm always away and I'm always kind of demanding, and sometimes I bring my own frustrations at home. But to have that anchor and that space in which you can be yourself and love, and people will accept you as you are with all your shortcomings and frustrations and weaknesses and even strengths sometimes. I think that's really great to have that within the family. But spiritually speaking, you know, the empty tomb in Jerusalem, the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, is a constant reminder of the victory of Christ and the hope that is living within us. And for me, like to be physically walking across and by the Holy Sepulchre and to be reminded time and time again that the tomb is empty is a constant reminder that the word, the final word, is for life, light and peace, and not death and alienation.
That's a great note to end on. I just thank you so much. You're an inspiration, and you know, there are people listening who are probably going through trials and great challenges of their own, but you're going through so much. Would you have a parting word that you might just share for anyone who's listening who is dealing with big challenges in their own life? What kind of wisdom would you give them?
You know what, I used to, when I was a little kid, you know, like, my mom would tell me, if you look at the disaster of those, you know, like your neighbors, your disaster will and problem will seem so small. This is by no way to diminish what people are going through. Everybody carry a certain burden, or they find difficult trials and hardships. And I think the first thing is to do is, you know, like to be anchored in the one thing that they love and they find joy in their life, and they have to cling to that, because that will be their source of inspiration and the energy in which that will give them perseverance. And the second thing is resilience. You know, like, you know, they have to build resilience somehow. And I myself, you know, like, you know, find it with everything that is going around me and all the challenges and the hardships and even looking for words how to express myself, I think we need to build that. It's like building muscles. You have to build resilience and think that, okay, you know, I will do what I can do, but I need to also believe that the Lord will provide. Because with every experience, with every hardship, with every trial, God will find a way out for you. And I think, you know, we have to deeply believe in that if we want to allow God to intervene in what we're doing.
That's a beautiful message. And, you know, our deep hope is that many people listening will say, you know, I'm so touched, I want to make a difference, and that they'll reach out to the American Friends of the Episcopal Diocese of Jerusalem and lend their strong resources, not just once, but get behind this in a committed way, because the ministry that you're offering every day and every year is life-transforming, like the Mount of Transfiguration. It is changing lives, Muslim lives, Jewish lives, Christian lives, and God bless you in what you do. It's been a grace to have you here today.
Thank you very much, Father Mike. Mm-hmm.